Welcome to the Spoolcast. Rachel Neighbors joins Adam Churchill in this follow-up to a virtual seminar, Improve UX with Animation. Rachel didn't have time to answer all the questions during the seminar, so we decided to address those remaining questions in this podcast. If you didn't attend the seminar, don't worry, there's plenty here for you too. And now, here's Adam.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Spoolcast. Recently, Rachel Neighbors presented a wonderful virtual seminar to our UIE audience. It's called Improve UX with Animation. Now, the recording of this seminar, along with 210 other UX seminars, is now part of UIE's All You Can Learn. Animation often gets a bad rap for being nothing more than decorative and sometimes even in poor taste. But it turns out animation can add value to the digital world by making interactions more intuitive, interesting, and seductive. In her seminar, Rachel showed our audience how animation can benefit user experience. And in today's podcast, she's offered to come back and talk a bit more about it and even answer some of the questions that our audience had that we just didn't get to. Hey, Rachel, thanks for coming back.
Hey, Adam, thanks for having me.
So for those that weren't with us for your seminar, can you give us a bit of an overview on what you talked about?
Sure thing. Well, first we started off by going over animation theory. There are studies going all the way back to the 1990s, fascinating research papers about how transitions and animations can be used in operating systems to help offload a lot of cognitive work into the visual cortex. So we talk quite a bit about that. I feel like that's a really big justification for why you should be considering animation early on in the workflow. And then we got into like six awesome principles of animation that you should keep in mind when you're working with your interactions: causality, feedback, location, progression, physics, transition, and how to combine them to reinforce an interaction's relationships and structure and cause and effect. And in the second part, we get into the best practices you should keep in mind when you're using animation so you don't throw off users by animating too much. And finally, we get into where animation fits in your process and how to spot good candidates for things that could be animated or transitioned.
Excellent. So yeah, the second part of your presentation really spoke a lot about, I like this idea of animation. I get that I should be using it. How do I work it into my process? So the team from Electronic Ink asks, do you have a preferred process for deciding when to incorporate animation within a design project?
So in most people's processes, they start with a lot of research, or at least we hope that that's how people are starting their design project. They start by researching the users, finding out exactly what you're trying to do with your project. And this is a good time also to start thinking about animation, right around the time that you've kind of figured out what the body of your information architecture is going to look like and what your users' tasks are going to be. It's right around here that you're going to start paying attention to changes in state. Like, example would be when going from loading to loaded. If you have lots of heavy information that's going to take time, that probably could use some sort of an animated indicator. You also want to look for changes in information environment and users switching topics, switching domains, like going from invoices to expenses. Also look for changes in task, going from reading to writing to searching, for example. Those are three different tasks, and they require very different environments, and transitioning between those environments will provide a better experience than if you just jump all over the place. And lastly, anytime there's a change in content, things appearing or disappearing from the page, in existing sites, you want to look for page loads and repaints, AJAX calls. If the user is going from one place to another or information is being loaded and unloaded from the page, those are pretty easy tells.
Kurt wanted to know a bit more about when you've got people thinking about these animations and you actually have an opportunity to plan them early, at what point do you discuss how the animation is going to be executed? For example, deciding on the technology you're going to use to do it.
That's a very good question. It depends, actually, on how big your team is. Now, for large companies, you typically want to have your front-end developers available to inspect your prototypes once you get to the prototyping stage. So ideally, after you've done all your research and you've done your studies, you start wireframing, prototyping, and storyboarding. Not in that order. Usually you start with wireframes and storyboards, and then you start making little prototypes. And prototypes are then passed around to different stakeholders and different developers. And also you use them to test on actual users to see if you're sniffing up the right tree. Now, in a large company, you want front-end developers to be looking at those prototypes and going, yes, we could achieve this sort of animation by using the da-da-da-da framework, or we could extend our current framework to achieve this in this way. That's when you want to have developers poking their noses in. However, if you're on a smaller company and you're experimenting with animation, say, in a branch or a copy of your product, you'll want to start discussing this with your coders while you're actually storyboarding. It'll be way more collaborative and it'll be informal. You'll probably have technology informing your design a lot more than if you're on that much more formal, larger company process. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. Both have their pros and their cons. With larger companies, things feel less collaborative, they're more dictatorial, but that also means that the designers have a finer hold on how things are supposed to perform. The drawback is that it can lead to miscommunications between developers and designers. So both have their pluses and their minuses.
Patricia's wondering if you can talk a bit about animation tools that exist for designers who can't code.
Well, Patricia, we are in a good space right now because a lot of companies have realized that motion is something more and more designers are into, especially because we are seeing more prototyping tools for apps and web apps. And in the app environment, animation is already very common. So when these companies start extending out these prototyping tools to incorporate the web, they still have all those animation features. Hurrah! So right now, what I'm hearing the most about when I interview companies is InVision and UXPin. They are two services that you can use to build out animation and, well, not just animation, but you can actually design an entire website inside them and create user flows and shareable prototypes, and they have animation features. So this is a great way you can get the entire team in and collaborating with it. There's also Flinto and Pixate. They are more app-oriented. They were designed originally for apps. You're going to see a lot more boilerplate for app-type interactions, and whereas InVision and UXPin encompass the full spectrum of devices. So the pros of these are that they are built for teams. They have lots of sharing features built into them. They support a lot of different workflows, a lot of different software. So, you know, you can import things directly from Photoshop or Sketch. The cons are that they are services and they require a heavy learning investment. You kind of have to try them out, you know, like grab a person and say, hey, you, I want you to go try out all these different things and find the one you think works best for our company's requirements. And then they come back to you and say, yeah, we're going to need X number of licenses. So they're commitment intense. And if you're not feeling committal, that can be an issue. Or if everyone's like you're on a smaller team and everybody very much has their own processes that they'd rather adhere to, having one person use one of these might be sort of self-defeating. So the other options our Google Web Designer, which is designed for making ads, but the nice part is that it's free and it does let you create very tiny example animations and export them directly to code that you can just put up on a server. And there's Adobe's Edge Animate, which has the very familiar Flash type interface that we've all grown up with. And for that reason, it's fairly easy for designers to pick up. They have great timeline tools. The cons are that they're less feature-rich, they're better for smaller one-offs and clarifications, but they don't take over your design process. So all of these, by the way, do not create product-ready code. These are strictly for prototyping and sharing. You wouldn't want to take any of these things and just put them into production.
We had a bunch of folks that were asking about shorthand that might be used for specifying common animations. Got anything for that? What do you suggest?
Oh, absolutely. Good question. So when it comes to, especially when you're documenting animations, it can be a good idea to put those animations into sentences. For instance, for me, I tend to write out my animations with a formula that goes, you list the trigger and the event, the thing that's being animated, the property, how long that animation lasts, and what your easing is. So that would be sort of like, on load, the width goes from 25% to 100% using ease in over 300 milliseconds. And that's the sort of way I write it out in documentation. It makes sense to front-end developers, and it's still legible for designers as well.
Rachel, we have a question about easings. You spent some time talking about those in the presentation. How do you keep a team of designers and implementers from each using different easings and durations on every little thing that they're trying to put in play? Isn't that hard to manage in the long run?
So easing is a measure of a rate of change. For instance, imagine a ball rolling across a table. Now, that rate of motion isn't constant. If gravity starts affecting the ball halfway across the table and it starts slowing down and finally it crawls to a stop, right? Now, the word for that would be ease out, which is a way of saying it eases out of its motion. It slows down over time. There are many different kinds of easing. There's ease in, where it starts slow and ends fast. It's kind of an acceleration easing. There's linear, where the rate of motion is constant. It looks very, very mechanical and unnatural to the human eye because there are no constant rates of change in nature. Now, when it comes to a large team and you have many different motion designers, front-end developers coming in, and sometimes they might feel like, well, this drop down here, it needs an easing for when it comes in. I'll just use ease in or ease out or define my own custom cubic Bezier and use that. A cubic Bezier, by the way, is a way of defining your own rate of change. It's a formula, a mathematical formula that you can plug into your CSS. So there is the ability for people to willy-nilly slap all kinds of easings on things. And that can be a problem because easing is also a form of branding and a sort of a physical interface for people. Now, many sites that have a very cohesive animation feel use custom easings for pretty much everything. I mean, CSS comes with a set of easings out of the box, but like I said, you can define your own. And that's why I think it's important in the beginning for somebody to take charge of how that feel, that rate of change throughout the entire project should feel. So it's good if you're using CSS, like using a preprocessor, to define a couple of custom easings up front and say in your design documentation, when you're easing out, we want you to use variable ease bounce. If you're changing something's opacity, we want you to use ease fade. And if you're using a JavaScript-based animation framework, you can define similar functions and just inform your developers to only use those functions. It'll have to become a part of your best practices that people don't just slap in the defaults, but adhere to the ones that have been approved and trained to work with.
Rachel, the team at DocuSign wanted to know a bit about your thinking on Google's material design. In your opinion, have they done a good job at creating an animation framework that can be applied across lots of different interfaces?
It's interesting because when it first came out, it was the first time anybody online had given motion design like an actual page in their documentation in public. And it wasn't just a page, but it was many pages that were devoted to this. For people who don't know, Google's material design is sort of like a skin for the problem or project. It's sort of like Twitter Bootstrap. And it's got a lot of animation in it. For instance, when you move from page to page, it's transitioned. And so when it first came out, everyone was really excited. But it was only a matter of weeks before some people started saying, well, I feel like the animations are kind of slow. And to be fair, that is true. The animations are often tied to page loads. So if the page load is slow, the animation probably feels slow too. This can be one of the difficulties with getting your animation timings right. We talk a bit about that in the seminar. But specifically, I think like this is the first time we have seen so much energy put into making motion an upfront and center part of a design process. And it's one of the best stabs I've seen. I mean, material design spans so many different devices and so many different use cases that it was no small undertaking to do that. It was very ambitious, and I think they did a great job given that challenge. Certainly, there are things we're going to learn from it as we watch people use more and more projects made with this product. But it's a useful educational experience we're going to gain from.
Rachel, tell us about what you use for prototyping.
All right, so my prototyping process is really unglamorous. I've just told you all about these fancy tools that people can use. Like when I interview people, I know that there are some design teams where they all make movies of how something should look using After Effects, and other people, they subscribe to UXPin and InVision. And they have these really nice, tight prototyping processes. But for me, I tend to just send clients wireframes and animatics, or tiny little movies of wireframes in action. And then I tend to work directly with code. I use Sublime Text. And as I'm coding, I send users either links to GitHub pages where the code's in action, or I send them actual videos of, well, what do you think if we made it work like this? And it's small, but that's because I'm a small company out here. And if I were working on a much larger project, I would probably insist that we codify that a bit more and start bringing in some of the more formalized products. But for now, this suits me just fine.
Very cool. So, Rachel, we ask people like you to come to our virtual seminar program for your expertise, and our audience is usually jonesing to hear a bit more about where they can get more of your thinking and your great teaching. What do you got for them?
Well, I can't recommend my newsletter, Web Animation Weekly, enough. I curate it every week. I send out fresh links to everything from implementation updates to inspiration for how animation can fit into your workflow. It's the best news in all things animation and motion from across the web. And you can sign up for it at webanimationweekly.com. And if you do something wonderful with animation in the future, we also accept submissions. So please, we'd love to see what you're working on. Also, in October, I've got a special announcement. I'm organizing a conference devoted to animation on the web. It's called Kinetic, and you can learn more about it at kineticpdx.com.
Rachel, that was great. Thanks for making some more time for us.
Thanks for having me, Adam, and thank you, audience.
And to our audience, thanks for your support and for listening in. Goodbye for now.
You can access the recordings of all of our past virtual seminars as part of UIE's All You Can Learn. For more information, visit aycl.uie.com. That's aycl.uie.com. As always, thanks for listening.